case this morning is State v. Stephen R. Braish. Mr. Davis, good morning to you. You may approach. Is it pronounced Braish?
Braish.
Yes.
Good morning. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is James Martin Davis. I'm an attorney for the appellant in this case. My client has spent plus 11 years at the Nebraska State Penitentiary for the first-degree murder conviction of killing his father. Before I get to the issues, I want to make some admissions and concessions. First of all, with respect to premeditation, I've been practicing law for a long time. I can't tell you how many murder cases I've had, so it doesn't take much to establish premeditation. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that, even though I raised the brief. I'm more concerned with the deliberate malice as opposed to premeditated malice, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. Like I told you, since I've been practicing law for almost 40 years, I would have been out of business long ago if it hadn't been for drugs and alcohol. They keep your practice going. And so I know that voluntary intoxication and voluntary drug use is not a defense. But you have to keep in mind that drugs, legal or illegal, are mind-altering. And they impair a person's ability to think clearly, and so that's how drugs and alcohol impact particular cases involving intent or involving malice. And so that's where I want to direct my comments today. So I don't want to be distracted with the idea that we're saying it wasn't premeditated necessarily, or that there's somehow a defense involved here because there was my client was under the influence of drugs and alcohol. Third, with respect to waiving a jury, I think that's an important decision. There's a couple of things I'd like to talk about there. First of all, I think you'd know, just a matter of general information, that when a client waives a jury, he doesn't do that on his own. He always does that on the advice and consent of his counsel, and that's always based on a determination of who that judge might be. And in order, the concern I have in the law, and this is probably not necessarily a case to raise it, but it's something I'd like to put in your mind, and that is, under your cases, the case in Nebraska, if somebody waives a jury and they want that right back, it's discretionary with the court. Now, why is that? Why isn't it the discretion of the defendant? Why doesn't he have? That's the most important right we have under the Constitution, is a right to a jury. And if you waive that in this state, now in order to get it back, you have to throw yourself at the feet of the judge and beg, borrow, or whatever to get that right back.
Well, one of the considerations might be the lateness in the day of the waiver, and the parties have prepared for a bench trial and the logistics of getting a jury.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that's certainly a consideration. But it shouldn't overrule that defendant's absolute right to have a jury. And there's factors that mediate both ways. But in Nebraska, the impact, Judge Connolly, is that you almost never get it back because you put it in the hands of the judge who can simply say,
but,
no.
But did you seek a withdrawal of your waiver of a jury?
No, in this case, I didn't try the case. I'm just here. I have to play
we
the cards.
We didn't either.
Yeah.
Was there a timely request to withdraw that waiver?
No, there wasn't. There was not. Yeah, I think that the affidavits that were laid out to you in terms of...
does that failure to make a timely request in itself constitute a waiver?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think in this case, my client, as I understand the facts, that he thought that the case was going to be transferred to Judge Kelch, and it said in the order for hearings and trial, but I think in the affidavits, the attorneys said, well, they thought it was going to go back to Judge Zastera. It went back and forth, and that was the basis of the fact that my client, he didn't find out until the day before, supposedly, it wasn't going to go back to Zastera. That's not a case of necessarily judge shopping.
What difference should that make?
In terms of what?
He wanted to try it in front of a different judge, and therefore he...
Well, because that's an informed decision. Some judges... let me give you an example. If I was going to try a case in front of Thurgood Marshall, I may want to waive jury. But if it got transferred to Anton Scalia, that's the last place in the world I want to be. Now, those are genuine concerns.
So you think it's a buffet line you can walk through and you can pick your judges?
Not at all. Because judge shopping begins if you're going to pick a jury. When you have a judge, and you ought to be able to stick with him. I mean, if you have hearings and you establish a rapport with him. So it's not necessarily judge shopping. I mean, if you have a judge, and you got Thurgood Marshall, and you like him, and all of a sudden now, you're going to Anton Scalia. Are you going to say that you're going to have the same kind of tribunal? I mean, we got to deal with reality and not just the ideal that one judge is the same as the other, because they aren't.
Davis, if Judge A is assigned to a case and the defendant waives the jury with the expectation that he's going to have Judge A, and Judge A dies and the case is assigned to Judge B, why should the mere happenstance of that affect or provide an opportunity for the defendant to sort of reclaim a right that he had clearly, voluntarily, and intelligently waived?
Well, if the judge dies, he can't have the case in front of that same judge. It's an impossibility. There's a difference in terms of facts here. I mean, if you waive a jury and then your judge is still there and it's transferred to another judge, I mean, I think you have a vested interest in that. If a judge dies, you know, in the process, you're going to have, in order to have a trial, you're going to have a judge.
What does the record tell us about Judge Zastera's status at the time of the trial in this?
Well, he was ill, he was sick at the time, and he excused himself, and then went to Judge Kelch. And then there was, as I understand it, based on the affidavits that we got from counsel, that there was a discussion that he was going to come back. And that was the anticipation, that he was going to come back for the trial. And then he didn't. It went back to, they thought it was going to go him, and went back to Judge Kelch again.
And after he didn't, as you've already conceded, no effort was made to withdraw the waiver.
As I told you, I can only play the cards I've been dealt. And there wasn't anything on the record with respect to that. But again, my client, you know, he does this on the advice, consent, and counsel, and he can't do that on his own.
You made reference to Nebraska law several times. Do other states treat this differently? Do they use a different standard?
No, I mean, I think it's probably 75%, just like Nebraska does. I mean, you go to California and you go to, you know, some of the southern states, a little bit different. But I mean, I think by and large, it's discretionary. But you look at our cases, and I don't know that there's any kind of defendant any slack with respect to that. I think in terms of getting into the issues, you got to look at, before we talk about this issue, let's look at the defendant and all the facts presented. I mean, here's a guy that just wasn't normal. On July 13th, when he killed his father, look at the constellation of facts. I mean, for 6 days, he was isolated in a dark basement bedroom. You know, for a whole week, he couldn't get out of bed, wouldn't go to work, was on family leave because of depression, diagnosed with bipolar disorder. Remember, bipolar used to be called manic depressive, but that's exactly what we had here. He was on prescription drugs, Xanax. That's a benzodiazepine, you know, with all the side effects. If you look at the physician's desk reference, or, you know, confusion, agitation, hostility, suicide ideation. There's one empty pill bottle there. There's one almost empty. I mean, his mom and dad were going to kick him out because of all these mood swings. Okay, this guy is just not normal. I mean, something's wrong with this guy. He thought he was going to die of AIDS, or he had AIDS. I don't remember whether he told his mother that or I heard that from him. But in any event, if you got AIDS, sooner or later it's going to put you in the grave. It's a benzodiazepine. You mix that with alcohol or other medications, it's mind-altering. So whether it's legal or illegal, you know, this guy was under the influence, had a mental disorder. His mother said, who knew him best, what's his mother say? He just not wasn't right. He came up before he shot. He just wasn't right. He didn't look right. Okay, so that's where we start. You know, that's the kind of guy we have here. So in that context, that's how we discuss the issue of deliberate malice, deliberate premeditated malice. And we couple that with the testimony of the expert that showed that this man just couldn't form any volitional intent. It wasn't deliberate with respect to what he did to the matter.
Excuse me, Mr. Davis. Wasn't the expert's opinion, is the bipolar disorder limited his ability to effectively regulate his behavior on that day?
Yes.
And that his opinion would be the same regardless of his substance abuse. Now, is that the same regulating, limited his ability to effectively regulate his behavior, the same thing that he would not be able to form the intent?
No. There was
to me, it sounds like it's intent and what your expert said are two different things.
That what we're saying, what the defendant was, what the expert was prevented from saying, was that was part of what we raised as an issue, that he was prevented from getting into the opinion that he, there was no proffer made in this case, but what there was is voir dire from the county attorney, which established generally what he was going to opine about, and the judge didn't let that in. And so basically, his testimony was, you know, what he was going to say is...
But there was no proffer.
No, but I mean, I don't know that there necessarily needs to be, because the prosecutor voir dired the witness said basically what he was going to testify about, and the prosecutor objected, said that's irrelevant, or that he's not a judge, he can't make a legal decision, and that they said that they were, because of the law with respect to voluntary intoxication, not being defense. Well, that wasn't the issue. You know, the issue is not, as it's defense, it's a fact or circumstances that relates to the element of the crime. Now, anytime somebody, when you see this guy, you see what I've just described, he's messed up. Folks say, why is he messed up, and what does that have to do? Doesn't, whether it's drugs or alcohol or whatever, a mental disorder, that is always relevant to the issue of intent.
What was the legal basis on which the opinion was rejected?
That it was the defense of voluntary intoxication. And that wasn't what it was.
On the legal basis this witness is not entitled to give a legal opinion?
That was what they judged, but I think what the judge made his opinion about with determination, two things. Number one, he wouldn't let it in because the prosecutor raised the idea that, well, yeah, this is voluntary intoxication. You know, you can't use that as a defense. That's what was raised. And later, the judge didn't consider it because, in his final opinion or judgment in the end, because he said, in effect, it didn't meet the Daubert standards. Now, that's kind of confusing because...
Well, you didn't have a Daubert hearing, did you?
No, they never raised it. I mean, they'd have to say, well, we need to have a Daubert hearing. And Daubert hearings are just for the purpose of...
So was the judge implicitly saying this witness is not competent to give a legal opinion?
No, not a legal opinion, a medical opinion. That's what he said in the end. He let it in. Okay. And then it's kind of, pardon my word, language, but bass backwards. I mean, you have the Daubert hearing first, and that's a question of admissibility. Whether it meets the test or not. And there was no objection, so it went in.
Are you saying that the judge had to give credence or credibility and fine because of the expert stated his opinion, he had to go that way?
Oh, no. I mean, it always goes to the weight. I mean, the trier of fact can always weigh
But I want to get back to the opinion itself. Did Neuring testify, that's the expert, testify that Brace's bipolar disorder prevented him from premeditating or deliberating the murder? Did he say that in his opinion?
Not the opinion he got in.
So
I think that's what he was going to say. That's what he was going to say. Not necessarily premeditated, but deliberate. That's what he was going to say if it got in. That's what we're saying.
Well, what exactly did get in?
I think what the judge read earlier, what Judge Connolly read earlier,
how was that helpful to the trial judge, that opinion that came in?
It's what would have been helpful to the trial judge and the defendant is if what the expert was prevented from testifying was going to testify too. That's the part of the error we're raising, Judge. Oh, I have some rebuttal time.
Thank you very much. Ms. Klein, good morning.
May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, I'm Kimberly Klein, Assistant Attorney General representing the state in this matter. Your Honor, with respect to Dr. Neuring's testimony, it started out as being less than clear about what his charge actually was to do. He stated that he had been retained to determine, quote, what was going on with Stephen Braish on July 13, 2013. I'm not even really sure what that means. I don't know if the district court was either. I think the district court ultimately allowed him to give his opinion about what was going on with Stephen Braish on July 13th.
Other than the effect of alcohol, wasn't it?
Yes, uh-huh. But the district court, as it is entitled to do, as any fact finder is entitled to do, basically said, I'm not giving it much credence because I don't think Neuring had sufficient facts to have legitimately reached the conclusion that he did. And if you go back and look at what Neuring actually looked at in order to reach his conclusion, I think that's exactly right. I think you have to look at what he did see, and I think more importantly, you have to look at what he did not look at. Neuring didn't
review. So is that a ruling that there was a lack of foundation for an opinion, whether or not the opinion was suitable?
I think essentially that's what it was. I think the district court said, I will allow you to give your opinion based on what you have seen, but I'm not going to give it much weight because I think there was a lot you should have looked at that you didn't look at. Neuring didn't look at any information from medical providers. He didn't look at or listen to any of the jail phone calls, some of which were offered as evidence. He didn't look at any of the jail records about the defendant's behavior while he was incarcerated. The only family member he talked to was the defendant's mother, even though the defendant had indicated to him that he was angry with and had violent thoughts about a brother. And I think more importantly, he didn't really look at the defendant's jail medical records. He apparently looked at them to the extent, or frankly, I'm not sure where the information came from, but Neuring reported that Braish had been put on Depakote while he was in jail, which is essentially a mood stabilizer. And beyond that, there's virtually no medical evidence other than that which came from Braish himself. And Braish's information is self-reporting, and he's reporting that he's on methamphetamine. His mother indicated he may have been taking steroids. He got a bunch of medications via FedEx, and frankly, we don't know what he took, what he didn't take, how much he took, what he was supposed to be taking. There's just a whole universe of information out there that was not considered when Neuring reached his conclusion, and I think based on that, the district court properly said, I'm really not going to give this much credence because I think there are just too many holes in this for me to give it a lot of weight and credibility. With respect to the issue of deliberate and premeditated malice, that's essentially a single element as it's been defined by our statutes and by this court. Just recently in Escamilla, this court said deliberately means suddenly, not rashly, and requires that the defendant have considered the probable consequences of his act before doing the act, and premeditated means to have formed a design to commit the act before it's done. The district court and the facts ultimately show that this is exactly what happened in this particular case. After the defendant was told by his family, or by his father, that he was going to have to move out because they couldn't put up with his mood swings anymore, he walked down 12 stairs to his room in the basement, retrieved the rifle, walked back upstairs with the rifle, and without saying a word to anyone or giving any warning, as soon as he hit the top of the stairs, he opened fire. He literally emptied the rifle. When the deputy found the rifle, he worked the lever on the action a couple of times, and there were no more shells in the chamber. 7 rounds had been shot, 5 of which struck the victim. And I think most importantly, 2 of those shots were in the head at very close range, as evidenced by the powder stippling on the head of the victim. After the shooting, he simply set the rifle down and walked outside, essentially waiting for the police to arrive. Once they did arrive, he was very calm, generally compliant with the officer's requests, and was taken into custody after that. I think these facts clearly show that it was a deliberate and premeditated act. I don't think there's, frankly, any way. Yes, was he a normal human being? No, apparently he hadn't been for quite some time. But I think the fact that he was able to, and in fact did, engage in these series of steps which culminated in the death of his father clearly indicate that he was thinking about what he was doing. And because the fact that the rifle that was used was a lever-action rifle, it requires that there be a manual effort between each shot, which you basically work the action to eject the spent shell and load
That's no different than pulling the trigger each time. That's just part of the way that rifle functions.
Yes, but it requires some... You have to actually do it and engage in it, and you have to continue. You have to think, I'm going to do this again. It's not like a semi-automatic where all you do is
pull the trigger. What was the time between... is leaving his father and going down the basement and coming back up? How much time elapsed between that?
I don't know that anybody said. It would probably not very much, just enough time to walk down a dozen stairs, get the rifle out of the case and come back upstairs with it. Maybe, I don't know, 30 seconds, a minute maybe.
Was there any attempt to instruct on manslaughter?
Well, it was a trial to the court, so I don't think there would be instructions.
To consider the charge?
I don't know that the district court did or not. I don't think
the trial court indicated that there was no evidence of a quarrel.
That's true, yes. The district court did note that there was no evidence of a quarrel. And so I think it actually probably did then consider the potential manslaughter.
What prompted the... What was the motive for him to go downstairs and get the gun and come back up?
He had just been told that you've got 30 days to move out. We are done dealing with you. It's time to be a big boy. And that apparently was, for him, at least the last straw, for whatever reason. And that, upon hearing that, he turned, went downstairs, and the homicide ensued. With respect to the motion for new trial, not getting the judge you want is not a basis for a motion for new trial. They phrased it as irregularity in the proceedings, but frankly, on these circumstances, I don't think the proceedings could have been any more regular. Judge Sestera became ill, had to essentially drop out of all his cases because of the illness, and there was a docket entry on June 24th that said the case is transferred for all future hearings and for trial to Judge Max Kelch.
Suppose that Judge Sestera had not become ill. They just decided to transfer it for whatever reason, docket, congestion or whatever. Would that change anything?
I don't think so. I think when you have a right to a jury trial, and when you waive that right to a jury trial, that's all you've done. There's no quid pro quo in this. You have a jury trial. You don't have any more right to a trial for a particular judge than you have to have any particular juror sit on your case. As long as you have a fair and impartial fact finder, the constitutional requirements have been satisfied. Judge Sestera was obliged to drop out, and on the 24th, there was the entry that it would be transferred for hearings and for trial to Judge Kelch. The trial didn't begin until July 15th, and no complaint about the switch in judges was ever made until after he had been found guilty of first-degree murder. And then it was phrased as a quote-unquote irregularity in the proceeding, which it clearly is not. It's about as regular in the proceedings as it can possibly be. So I think the district court properly overruled it, even though it really isn't a motion for new trial, and I don't think there was any error in that respect. If there are no further questions, I would ask that the judgment and sentence be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? 5 minutes and 28 seconds, Mr. Davis.
Thank you, Judge. Well, I disagree with counsel on the other side because I'm going to read from several cases. It says deliberate malice and premeditated malice are separate and distinct elements of the crime of murder in the first degree. So they aren't one elements. This is what you said in State versus Martin, State versus Lyle, and State versus Cook. So you've got two different aspects to the same convoluted element, deliberate malice and premeditated malice. So there are two. As I conceded from the beginning, it doesn't take much to establish a premeditation. Right, you're quick. He went downstairs and he came back and he shot him. I mean,
why wouldn't somebody argue that this was a sudden quarrel and
I don't know.
If your father kicks you out of the house and you go downstairs within 30 seconds and come back up and shoot him seven times, isn't that fairly sudden?
It certainly is. Does a quarrel have to be both ways?
Why isn't this assigned as an error in the case? We're not considering involuntary manslaughter.
I think there wasn't any error preservation with respect to that. I don't know that I could have, in good faith, raised that. I mean, I think we've got the issue of the deliberate malice as it relates to the testimony that didn't come in. But, you know, in this instance, certainly, you know, you can make your decisions in terms of whether or not there was premeditated malice. I mean, they're two different things. And, you know, the fact that when you talk about, there's no question this guy was messed up, but what does jail phone calls have to do when he's in jail? What does that have to do with his mental state? What is jail medical records, if any? They're all after the fact. And that's it. They're saying that the court discounted the testimony of this expert because of these factors. I mean, the guy had the credentials. He testified. He's a PhD psychologist, and he testified that my client had some kind of mental disorder. I mean, that's where you have to start on these cases, and then you go there. You don't start at premeditation, then try to adjust the facts to what the law is. I mean, you've got it. Just likewise with just common sense in terms of evaluating this case. Again, and particularly as it relates to waiving juries. I mean, the fact is, the reality is, ladies and gentlemen, that who your judge is one of the most important factors in determining whether you're going to waive a jury.
Counsel, I did not read anywhere in your brief that you had any quarrel with the completeness and accuracy of the proceedings that led to the waiver of the jury. Is that correct?
Yes. I mean, there was...
It was knowingly and intelligently.
Knowing that Judge Sestero was the judge, intelligently knowing that Judge Sestero was the judge, you can't read that out. You can't ignore human nature, because that is you. What, there's a decision there. You're going to waive a jury, or you're going to have a jury to try it, or you're going to have your judge try it. That's decision.
Okay. Suppose he hadn't waived the jury. The jury is impaneled. He takes a look at this jury and says, "I don't like the looks of this. Now I want to waive my right to a jury." Would he be allowed to do that as a matter of right?
Probably so. I mean, it depends on whether the jury's sworn or not. But, I mean, that's just... these rights don't belong to the courts. They don't belong to the judge. The Constitution says they belong to a defendant. That's the most important right we have, is a right to a trial by jury. And so if you give that up, you're giving up a huge right. And it shouldn't be discretionary.
Who gets to waive that right?
Excuse me?
Who waives that right?
The defendant waives that right. He has that right, but is it an irrevocable waiver? I don't think so. I mean, why is it? Why do the courts say that? When it doesn't, it's a right that belongs to the defendant, given to him by the founding fathers long before any of our judges were alive. You know, I think it's a sacrosanct, and that he ought to be able to reinstate it if he wants. Unless, like I say, that's probably
But the fact is, he didn't. I don't know if anybody's disagreeing with you that you can take back that waiver, but nobody did it here.
Yeah, well, I think the affidavit said it disclosed why. Like I say, Judge, I don't play much poker. I just have to play the hands I've dealt with, and I wish to heck there had been an attempt to waive that jury and to revoke that waiver, and the judge turned it down, because then I'd be making these same arguments, but probably in a more effective fashion. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That takes us to the next case of the day, which is State versus David E. Ware.